This all started a few weeks ago when Tommaso Hester, somebody from the relativity group, who'd come and explain Mond and Tevis. Frankly, I had never looked at these things at all, being, you know, full of theoretical prejudice. But I thought it was pretty bad if, you know, we couldn't produce one person to come over here and say something. But my knowledge is extremely limited. And furthermore, I've discovered it's a huge subject, right? I mean, it's not just one or two papers that are written on it. There's a truly vast literature. So my scholarship, my prejudices are large. My scholarship is poor, right? And my biases are evident. I'm not sure. I didn't keep track. I just noticed when I kept on Googling, right, you know, more papers came up, right? So I don't have the, it's one of those doomsday problem type of calculations where the evidence is there are a lot of papers out there because I didn't reach the boundary. But in the meantime, after this, we found that Sean Carroll, who's a real expert in the subject, and his own modified theories of gravity, is coming up here this Thursday, right, to talk. So I'm in the position of being like a warm-up act at the rock concert, right? I'm just here to tell you the little bit I know, right, about or was able to glean about Mond from a little survey of the literature. Now, everybody knows that Einstein's equation, right, doesn't work on scales above the scales of the solar system, say, at least not with the matter which we can see. So roughly speaking, there are two classes of ideas, right, for making Einstein's equations work. One is to introduce some new class of matter, which is to modify the right-hand side of the equation. But there's a small minority of people that would like to modify the left-hand side of the equation and not do something and leave the right-hand side of the equation alone. Of course, the division in the left and right isn't exact. You can move terms from one side to the other, but there's a rough idea that you should either pin it on gravity or the matter. Roughly, it's a simple idea about the matter, right? It's just some fluid of unknown particles and more complex ideas about the gravity. So I thought before tell you a little bit about Tevis, right, which is a relativistic version of Mond, I would just review very briefly, roughly where we are in testing Einstein's general relativity. And it's been tested on a variety of scales, from attoparsecs to milliparsecs to kiloparsecs, on up to gigaparsecs. Some of the tests are precise, typically the ones at lower scales, and others are qualitative. But the qualitative ones are important also. I've divided the tests roughly into two classes. Those you can deal with weak gravity, that is, small perturbations of a flat metric, and those that involve strong gravity, which, of course, are harder to measure. So just running it through very quickly, in the laboratory, of course, we don't exactly have tests of general relativity, but we've got excellent tests of prerequisites to general relativity, namely the equivalence principle, tested in a lab to a few parts in 10 to the 13, and I also should have probably written it down here, it's tested in the solar system from the fact that the Earth and the Moon fall towards the Sun with a slightly better accuracy, in fact, 1.5, I think, times 1.5 parts in 10 to the 13. We also, thanks to Eric Adelberger, have ruled out, and many other works, have ruled out many fifth force proposals down to the amazing scale of 80 microns, which were increasingly collides with, since gravity is so weak, it collides eventually with the electromagnetic forces that are overwhelming in condensed matter physics. On the solar system, we have the classical tests, the gravitational redshift, a few parts in 10 to the 4 from GPA, the bending of light, right, which is tested by VLBI to a few parts in 10 to the 4. The best test overall is the test of the bending of light that, well, it's really the differential Shapiro time delay coming from the Cassini mission a few years ago, 2 × 10⁻⁵, and the precession of the perihelion, which of course it relies on a large amount of astronomical data, but the key thing that's confusing there is whether the sun has a quadrupole moment. And from helioseismology, we know that the rotation curve of the sun in into about two-thirds isn't enough to support a large quadrupole moment, and that's consistent also with the observations. So it's tested with that proviso down to about 10⁻⁴. Moving on up in the weak tests, of course, gravitational lensing itself should be counted as certainly as a qualitative test of general relativity, but it's also been recently made by work of people who may be here, I was very pleased to see, into a quantitative test, and quite amazing. This parameter gamma is one of the PPM parameters, which is would be one in general relativity. And by looking at galaxies, well, you can tell me whether I'm saying this right, where both they can measure some information about the rotation curves and also the lensing, right, they get information on whether the gravitational bending is fit. Of course,
I have followed that, but what is the story about the Pioneer?
Oh, I don't know anything about the Pioneer anomaly, right, except that I noticed that in Jacob's papers, right, on Mond, he's always got graphs that have Pioneer anomaly on them. Well, my biases are severe, right, as I mentioned before, and if you have a complicated system like the two Pioneer space graphs, who knows, you know, a little gas out jetting or something like that. So I don't know what the story of the Pioneer anomaly is. Strong gravity, maybe the poster child, is the radiative, the slowdown of the first binary pulsar, right, by the Hulson-Taylor pulsar, by the emission of gravitational radiation, which agrees with Einstein's theory to about a fifth of a percent. Then there are a bunch of strong field tests in the increasing number of binary pulsar observations that have been made, and I'll summarize these over here from once again, all these things you see there. So, and you fit a whole lot of data in pulsar timing to the two masses of the binary objects, and if they typical plot looks like this, and then you have a bunch of things you measure, and you count it as a success if they all cross at one point. So there's a lot of and ongoing information. A number of things will be coming. GPB, I hope, will report soon, and that's a 1 over C cube effect having to do with motion, because general relativity implies not only do you have sort of static effects from the presence of mass, but you have current effects, which are gravitomagnetic effects, as they're called, because of the motion of matter. And, of course, we hope that we'll get some data on gravitational radiation. Moving up this side, black holes, of course, should certainly be counted as a success of metric theory. It's because I don't know how else you would get a compact object that's made out of pure spacetime, right, other than having a theory in black holes. We are missing Einstein's theory, of course, makes it because of the so-called no-hair theorems, namely that astrophysical black holes are characterized by just two numbers. The mass and angular momentum makes very detailed predictions about the structure of what the metric is outside of a black hole, which we don't really have access to, I think, right now, or very little at any rate. But from gravitational radiation, once again, we should be able to see for excited black holes their characteristic ring down period. And, of course, finally, on cosmological scales, the coherence of the Friedman-Robertson-Walker models at fitting a whole lot of data, both very early in the universe and now, the whole coherence of the cosmological picture, say, from Big Bang nucleosynthesis forward, I'm not talking about really early, fit by, a scheme for the matter for Friedman-Robertson-Walker models. Four parameters must be counted as a sort of success of general relativity. Indeed, I think it's probably clear that we're moving in cosmology from an epoch where the problem was that there was so little data, where you just assumed general relativity, right, and then tried to fit to those models. But now we found those parameters, you can begin to worry about whether general relativity actually applies on those scales as distinct from some other theory. Another way of summarizing this whole situation is the so-called PPN parameters, at least in the weak side of this over here. In the 70s, right, people like Clifford Will and Kip Thorne set out to sort of organize the data for experimental weak field experimental tests by trying to make arguments for what the most general form of the metric would be independent, right, of some particular theory in the weak field limit. And they developed what's called the PPN framework, which has all these parameters in it, gamma, beta, xi, a whole bunch of things like that. And these have been written in such a way that these numbers are zero in general relativity all the way down. And by now, you know, here's from Cassini, helioseismology, earth gravimeters. These are largely tested by binary pulsar timing. And I forget where these limits come from. But anyway, there's a lot of data to be, fit. So the message of this part of the talk is you want to replace gravity, you got to fit all this stuff, right? That's the first thing you should be doing. Okay, so now on to Mond, or what's called Tevis. This is Jacob Bekenstein's relativistic theory. I shouldn't say this. It's relativistic mind, so to speak. Everybody, all the theorists assume that, you know, we've got special relativity. We're not going to throw that out along with everything else, including Jacob. So this has the content of it. So we've got a metric. We've got a unit time-like vector field and a scalar field. And we have this metric, which is not the physical metric, that is the one in which the geodesics of particles are expressed, and that's determined, it's defined in this way. This is a definition, or this is the definition of G alpha beta. So they're actions. The action is a sum of a gravitational part, a piece for the vector field, a piece for the scalar field, and whatever matter action you've got, which involves all the other fields like the electromagnetic field in the universe. For SG, we have the usual Einstein action. A plus for Tevis is at least it's in four dimensions. For the scalar action, which for some reason I wrote down first, I got minus a half integral d4x square root of minus g times sigma squared, which is an auxiliary scalar field to be varied. So really this equation is nothing more than a sort of constraint on expressing the very complicated kinetic energy part of the the scalar field action. F is some function to be specified. K and L are constants in the theory. And H alpha beta equals G alpha beta minus U alpha beta. The vector field is given by something that looks sort of like a gauge field, electromagnetism. But constrained, right, because of the unit time length. So you've got a Lagrange multiplier in here divided by K And finally, you got the matter, where you take your usual matter, Lagrangian, whatever you like. This is with respect to G. Twiddle, Lagrangian, plus whatever matter fields you've got in there. So there's Tevens. It's got parameters. K and little k are dimensionless. And G and L are dimensional. L is essentially going to set, the combination between K and L is going to set the acceleration scale that occurs in MOND. And what is F? Well, F is given by Jacob's favorite choice, is you solve this little differential equation, which Keith pointed out to me, you can just sort of do by an integral. Okay, there it is. Now, how does this connect with MOND? Well, allegedly, if you take the static limit, first of all, statics, you have some killing factor C, and U lies along that, and you write down the usual static weak field metric for the physical metric. Then, the function phi that occurs in here, which looks like the Newtonian potential, is in fact some constant times the Newtonian potential plus the value of the scalar field phi as a function, which you've got to determine by solving all these equations. So, this is the Newtonian potential that arises from the visible matter. Remember, all the effort here is to get rid of the dark matter, in the galaxies at least. And so we only have, I don't know what you would call it, baryons, I guess.
Yeah?
Yeah.
The Taylor action, the H is a space-like metric, the G minus U combination. Yeah.
This thing.
Yeah. So you just defined it. Is that the sign is the one that makes this a space-like?
Well, they had a problem with some previous version getting superluminal propagation, and this is alleged to solve it. Yeah, I guess so. So, right. I did not go through and check that. Right, but that's the assertion. Okay, now, I can't imagine you're going to. I'll just. I think I'll keep the data. Right, and erase these. What? Pardon?
Question, H is a degenerate object, right? Is it?
Yeah.
It's a signature 3-0 object.
So how do they get rid of the superluminal propagation?
My knowledge is limited. All I know is that they put that in there, right, precisely to get rid of the superluminal propagation, they claim. Maybe it's now instantaneous. I don't know.
Well, I think you should leave this up and erase the data, because we're not going to repeat the data that's hearing it.
Right. let's see. Let's start up here. Okay. So, anyway, so you can recover MOND, right? Namely, in if you have the static plus spherical symmetry, and a you reduce to this equation, which is the original MOND equation, it says. some function mu, A, equals minus the gradient of the Newtonian gravitational potential. In other words, it's just Newtonian gravity, but with the F equal ma part modified by some function mu, which is linear down here on a scale, well, of x, I guess, corresponding to an acceleration a naught, which is the square root of 3k over 4 pi l. Okay. So that they're going to set to be the acceleration in galactic disk. Right? Otherwise, so galaxies are down here. We're typically in the solar system doing much bigger accelerations up here where Newtonian gravity is then okay. So effectively, at low accelerations, you're dividing by this function mu, and therefore the gravitational constant effect of gravity is enhanced, and you can hold more stuff in with less mass in the center. So that's it. That's my total understanding of Tevis and Mond. I think so. I mean, I don't see how. I didn't just see any discussion of, you know, how they were going to fix these from something. And other gravity. And I want to raise this issue in a minute. I once heard a talk by the great mathematician John Milner, right, who said when he got to the end of the talk, "Well, I've told you everything I know about this subject, therefore there can be no questions," and walked out. And that's roughly the way I feel now. But Stan is an old friend.
Years ago, when I looked at Mom, there were some upcoming observations. I don't know what they were, but they were supposed to be definitive in rejecting Mom. And presumably those observations have been made, so why are people still talking about Mom?
Oh, well, I'd like to hear from the rest. I agree with you. So that they're, as far as fitting the data, right, first of all, I believe there's a problem with clusters of galaxies. I tried to look up in Allen, right, and calculate the accelerations in clusters, and I got something like about, you know, for the typical galaxy in a big massive cluster, I got something like between 3 to 10 times as big as this 10 to the minus 10 squared. Does that fit with your... Anybody else do that? Anyway, that moves you up further up this curve, right? Out here, if I did the calculation right. Which
so
means
what? In the outskirts of clusters, for example, you know, the accelerations will be less than the say naught.
Bigger than the say naught, we hope. We want to move up this way, I think.
Well, so to test Mond, you want to be.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, I got it right. Well, I don't know. Are there dynamics of clusters that
Well, yeah. Well, you know, so the temperature profiles of clusters in Mond, I think, should be rising all. You know, they should be rising all the way to the center.
Right.
Whereas observed, you know, whereas the observed profiles in clusters, I think, will be at depths in small regions.
So what do you get?
Well, so the Mond proponents argue, you know, that dark matter is needed in clusters for the data. Mm-hmm. But they argue that this dark matter might be massive neutrinos.
Mm-hmm. So it might work.
Oh, you have to fine-tune the neutrino mass without dark matter in clusters, but not in smaller objects like galaxies.
Yeah, but that's... as a prejudiced theorist, right, that's not so very wonderful as to get rid of the dark matter in the galaxies and then not get rid of it in the clusters. Right. I mean, of course, it could be true, right, but it doesn't...
There used to be a website, University of Washington, discussing all these things about Mond.
I saw it. The Mond website.
And also outlining these observations.
That was another evidence. It was a lot of work.
If
you're complaining I didn't read any paper, right, I plead guilty. But I was struck by Professor Steinmetz's talk yesterday, where he listed a number of other pieces of evidence for dark matter in the galactic system, namely the escape velocity from galaxies, the kinematics of satellites, and the local group timing, right, between us and Andromeda. Now, I'd like to know from you all, how does Mon stack up on these, right? What if there's no dark matter, but we have Mon? For example, I tried to do the calculation of the acceleration between us and the Andromeda galaxy last night by the advanced method of putting in GMM over R squared and 10 to the 11th solar masses for each and dividing by 725 kiloparsecs, which the whole problem could be. And I got a much larger acceleration thing at 10 to the minus 5, not 10 to the minus 10, which would push that way up here. So there would appear to be a conflict between this and the local timing observations. Could you say something about dark matter and Mon in the galaxies from your very excellent talk yesterday?
Okay. For galaxies, the Mon argument essentially lies in two points. I think that is why that Mon piece is at all around us. I mean, to fit a rotation curve, okay, you introduce an acceleration constant and you fit a rotation curve. Yeah, no wonder. It always gets interesting if you change one thing and you're fixing two problems.
Right.
And for the galaxies, it was the rotation curves mm-hmm. that was designed for. And then if you use the same and apply it to the so-called scaling laws, the Pauli-Fischer relation, so mm-hmm. rotation velocity versus luminosity, you find that you easily reproduce the Pauli-Fischer relation for galaxies mm-hmm. with a relatively steep exponent, like luminosity goes like velocity to the fourth power. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you try to do that in a dark matter, and you get it with a very narrow scatter, you get a relation which is tight, which is mm-hmm. observed, and which correlates well. And in a dark matter theory, at least it's a non-trivial effort to explain mm-hmm. that. I think we can do that. But of course, just to do it with one thing, mm-hmm. changing parameter to fix that whole thing is a kind of more natural. So I think on the purely phenomenological galaxy side, mm-hmm. if you look at the individual galaxy dynamics, there's a very good point for that. Maybe that they fit those two, this is one change, they fit those two observations.
But what about the other things, the escape velocities, the velocities of satellite galaxies, and
I would have to look at the escape velocity. I think it would be pretty much the same result.
And what are the accelerations?
I don't know. I'm not sure about the timing argument, but for the escape velocity, it probably will be fairly similar.
And what about the accelerations of the satellites? Of satellite galaxies around our own? That's a bigger scale, right?
It's enough. I don't know whether someone has looked into that.
It'd be nice to look, right? I think, right? And, well, I mean, I was struck by that in your talk. So
there was a third thing which Stacy also shared here during the conference, something which is also not fully understood yet. If you look at rotation curves of galaxies, it seems at least that every feature in the light distribution has corresponding feature in the rotation velocity. Mm-hmm. And this is naturally being explained with Mon. Mm-hmm. It is not as trivially explained when you rely on a dark matter theory.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So there is something, say, for the simplicity of the recipe, it looks surprisingly good.
All right. Okay, thank you. Anybody else want to weigh on this subject? Yes, Stan.
Do I understand the satellite test correctly in the sense that Ron would say that their motion should be lower than they are because the gravitational attraction has been decreased because their head distance is lower than what we would imagine?
Well, it depends on the we need to know what the accelerations of the satellites are.
Is some kind of bound.
Yeah, v squared divided by r. What is that for?
If that's too small,
then you get Mon.
But you observe it. And you observe something requiring dark matter in the center to give it that acceleration. So isn't that a very definitive test?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's my question.
Yeah. I don't think so. Because my impression is that however you measure, even very far out, mm-hmm. if you transform this into an equivalent rotation curve, you almost get something close to flat rotation curve, which is what Mond has been designed to produce. So,
well, that's impressive if it works like that.
I don't think it's...
No, I mean, that isn't quite right. Right? I mean, the low volume kinematics of satellite galaxies from Sloan, both on average, but what they show is that, also for a large radius, the velocity dispersion declines with radius. Right.
At what radius?
Well, 100, 200 kilobar
size. Okay, so further out. Yeah.
Right. So if Mond were, like, you know, valid all the way out to these radii, like the real radii of galaxies, I would think that, like, you know, that Mond would predict flat velocity dispersion profile, like the flat rotation curves. Find that we see declining velocity dispersion profiles, I think.
And is that taking into account different assumptions for the velocity ellipsoid of the satellite?
So that's just the measured radial velocity, just as radial component. Right. You know, so you could, I guess, so you could play with the velocity anisotropy, but you need to try to compensate for that.
One question I have is whether the cold dark matter explains the peaks and troughs of the CMB spectrum, fluctuation of the spectrum pretty well. And so, you know, which argues for presence of cold dark matter in the early universe. And I'm just wondering what, you know, Ron and Simon say about, you know, where that dark matter is going now.
Well, applying it to cosmology hasn't escaped Jacob. So in his paper, Ryan, he does apply it to cosmology, not, of course, Mond, but Tevis. And he claims that, you know, you get roughly the same story. Now, what roughly the same story?
Without neutrinos, does it mean massive neutrinos?
I don't know. We could look it up, but I mean, that's an information retrieval.
I mean, the peak to the CMB data is a lot worse than CDM. Yeah. I mean, CDM works a lot better than the CMB data.
Coming from relativity, I mean, I would worry about whether the tests have been carried out, I mean, whether the calculation has been carried out that it's consistent with all these tests. In particular, I couldn't find any place where, you know, they calculated the PPN parameters for Tevis, right? And then, because, you know, these numbers are pretty strong. So that's like the first thing they should, somebody should do.
So that mu function, though, is free, I guess, right? You're free to take the deviation.
The mu function appears to me to be very carefully chosen by Jacob to do a bunch of things. It's not like it's, you know, it is very arbitrarily. You might, there's undoubtedly freedom in there, but I'm not sure how big as much it is.
Isn't it true that all the tests you presented here with general relativity are reaching the mark and essentially looks the same. You call it weak limit, but compared to the Mond scale, I think it's still fairly strong gravity solar system. And
you might well be right, but we've got numbers that are very tight here, right? So I'm not so sure which you might be right.
That's why I ask you this question about the Pioneer anomaly, which now is supposed to see from Pioneer 10 as well as from 11.
You asked for a talk on one thing I don't know anything about and have little faith in, right? I'm not going to give a talk on two things I don't know about and have little faith in particular the Pioneer anomaly. So it's not clear it's consistent with all the data that we've got. And I would worry about also these strong tests, right? And it's not so clear to me, you know, how do they fit the binary pulsars with Tevis, right? I couldn't find anything. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, right? No, Google only goes so far. Another thing I want to mention is that it's not the only idea in modifying gravity. From Sean, I hope you'll hear about his theory of modified gravity, which is designed to do the same problem, right? That is, get rid of dark something, but in his case, it's dark energy he wants to get rid of. So Sean has a theory which, in the right frame, so to speak, looks like this with an extra scalar field. Um, unlike Tevis, he wants, which introduces extra degrees of freedom, extra gauge fields, extra scalar fields. He, although this thing looks like it has an extra scalar field in it, he claims that, in fact, when properly analyzed in the right frame, it doesn't. Cosmological constant is going to be e to the minus 2 psi naught, where this is, I guess, some value at the bottom. And that, you know, is a sort of modification of gravity that he claims would produce acceleration, right, without introducing exactly a cosmological constant. He'll be here on Thursday. Get your questions ready. I don't know about that. Of course, it would be much nicer if we would have a theory which would get rid of both forms of dark matter, the ones in the galaxies, but maybe that's a little too much to ask for.
Should we read anything into the fact that the Mond acceleration is almost the same as the speed of light divided by the age of the universe?
Yeah, Gary was pointing this out to me, right, that it's the same as the cosmological constant. I don't know. Doesn't seem like the rotation, I mean, after all the rotational velocities are determined by the masses, which are determined by this upper limit set by fragmentation we understood from yesterday. That doesn't seem to have much to do with the cosmological constant, but what do I know?
Another question on the data. When people fit the rotation curves to get a k-naught,
mm-hmm.
I mean, do they always find the same number?
Yeah, I used to do, but not that much, many more databases. Still, no matter from dwarves to even dwarves.
Yeah, I think they claim this as a success, right? And I do remember seeing, you know, vast numbers of rotation curves, you know, all fit by the same one parameter.
When you go to clusters, you have.
Right, sure.
The Lagrangian for Mond looks, or for Tevis, looks so different from general relativity.
Right.
All these different fields, all this complication. Is there a claim that, you know, if you're above this weak acceleration, it actually does reduce to general relativity? That the modifications are only in this?
I don't think so.
No. So it would modify things around black holes.
Well, we could worry about gravitational radiation, black holes, all sorts of stuff. Well, at least I didn't see it. I mean, because the acceleration only seems to come in, right, in this very low-energy spherical, like symmetric, approximation.
David, I'm not an expert on this, and claim that if you do the proper transformation, you can actually get rid of the scalar fields. So it just reduces to a tensor factor field. I'm not sure, I mean, if that's...
You mean in Tevis?
In Tevis.
Right. That's not a... Right, it's a vector field somehow that's more worrying than the tensor field. So let me just conclude. So an assessment from... a relativist, Tevis, which I've unfortunately erased there, Lagrangian, certainly looks cooked, right, to a theorist. It's, and maybe the string theorist should speak to this, I'm just paraphrasing what Gary told me, Tevis is not really natural in string theory, for example, which provides a metric, gauge fields, and scalars, and mechanisms for giving the scalars masses so they don't interfere with this. But the particular Mond form, right, with its function, with its, you know, doesn't appear very natural. On the other hand, as often as the case in string theory, they can't exclude, right, since they don't know what the vacuum is, that you might not get it out somehow. So by contrast, somehow it's easy, right, in string theory. After all, they have a large number of particles. If listening to some of the talks, for example, in the string phenomenology program, the problem is, for example, to find a compactification in string theory that would produce the standard model and nothing else, right? No other particles coming around. So they don't have any problem generating particles. You want a few extra scalar fields, they can give them to you. And Mike is really looking increasingly pained, so maybe you want to say something.
Yeah, well, I mean, in fact, if we sat and stared at this Tevis Lagrange for a day, we would falsify it. You know,
Wow. Okay, good. There we go. So how about a little action in helping these people out? Right? He said if we meaning the collectivity of strength.
It's the flavor of things that people have looked at over the years and they have a major problem.
So what is it going to be inconsistent with?
It's easy to produce the standard amount of particles plus cold dark matter.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So that's nice.
That's what I was saying. That's what I, well, that was the thrust of what I was trying to say, right? They don't have, you don't have any problem producing particles for their models, whereas producing the gravity is sort of more of a problem. So what's it going to be inconsistent with? What do you think it's going to be, or what is the list of things it could be inconsistent with?
Well, I mean, the superluminal propagation.
Right, okay. Sorry, what's
it? You know, this question of whether it's, you know, unitary considered as a quantum theory.
Well, no, wait a minute. This is a low-energy sort of effective theory. It doesn't necessarily
have... We still have to come up with some theory that contains it. You can often see violations of unitary at low energy. And that's not a question of, you know, normalizability or something. That's a question about the interpretation of scattering, you know, amplitudes of particles at some energy.
Right.
It's not unitary, that energy, it's not good.
But
and then there's, you know, this vector field, you know, you have to ask, you know, you race it a little too fast. Is it massless or massive?
It's just, well, I don't know, it's a unit.
It's a unit time like
vector. Vector field.
Well, that just means that it's constrained, you know, that only certain components can move.
Oh. Right.
So are those components that can move massless or massive? If it's massless, it only certainly radiates in some way that immediately violates your pulsar,
mm-hmm.
you know, balance and so forth. So that's another obvious thing to look at.
Long-range anti-gravity.
Maybe it has long-range anti-gravity. Well, no, what? They check, I'm granting that they check the kind of naive
they, that, well, Jacob tests the bending of light and the precession of perihelion. Right?
So those are obvious things to look at.
Okay. Well, there's a professional view for you.
I just wanted to make a quick remark about the social energy capsule.
The one?
Something that I always wonder about is whether it is actually a theory that one might kind of believe enough in to actually spend time working on.
Same.
I mean, there is a handful of people who do work out these, who work on it, and then there are people who kind of more or less by accident stumble upon things which they see as possible tests of it and falsifications of it. But in principle, you know, nobody, for example, I think in the astronomy community or simulation community, I don't know how many people would be prepared to spend a lot of time running or devising a code that can actually run a simulation, a kind of, you know, simulation of these things, et cetera, et cetera. Because there's lots of problems with that, so you need to spend a lot of time in doing that. And I think that's kind of part of the problem as well, that the only people who actually spend time working on it are the ones who really firmly believe that it is true.
That's I've heard the opposite, you know, it's always good to have a competitive model, even if you don't totally believe it. How do you know what you're doing if you're only doing
it? Yeah, but I'm just wondering how many people are actually prepared to spend time, you know, actually working the details out.
Well, they might try, I mean, at least the proponents might try the things that Mike was mentioning, you know? Superluminal propagation, radiation, right? The things you naturally get by extra degrees of freedom.
Has somebody worked out the simple spherically symmetric weak field lensing predictions for Mond?
Yeah, I think so. Right. Yeah.
Is it in a form that's easily digestible by non-relativist?
Well, they had some problem with that, you know, which once again, it's the same. When they had measurements of the mass, right?
Maybe somehow got much more attention to this sort of what's sometimes called the DGP model, the Dari-Gandadazi-Ferrati model, which is something which is loosely inspired by string theory and higher dimensions. That one you can argue pretty convincingly, but after it now, it was also inconsistent, you know, and unstable, but people, again,
you
use it as a, you know, foil model for simulation. So.
What was the problem you said?
I would refer you to a paper of early this year by Arcani on you can look at stability and unitary just on energy processes.
Well, people could take a little time off and show some. There's obviously a lot of interest. Right?
Well, I think the version of Mon that I've ever had any discussion about was on the base of them. No good. I hadn't heard about this evidence, but we have to be sure we have the right one.
Well, you got to hit the ball back over the net, right? I mean, so they've got some relativistic theory, and it's clean. What?
Can someone say something about this bullet cluster results? I'm sure this is from you, Marisha, but where, I mean, certainly all the talks, or maybe just the press release, have said this proves cold dark matter, and seemed like it was a fairly difficult thing for Mon theories.
So the problem with this one, with Tevez, is that it's not, you can't really apply to the system yet because they don't have the non-symmetric quantum. Meaning you cannot model something that's elliptical to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the moment, no. I mean, Lamont or Tevez cannot explain the bullet cluster. But it might not be the end of the story because they haven't worked out the theory yet to the details we would need it. But at the moment when Hongxin Zhao was here Tuesday, talk about it, and they get gas masses which are factors off from what we see from X-ray observations. That's clearly inconsistent with the data, but it's yet again one cluster. So,
well, I heard this talk, right? I mean, in your talk as well. But I mean, they had didn't they claim they could fit it with some modification of what the dark matter was, some kind of neutrinos or something like that, plus mod.
But their gas mass is factored too wrong from what you see from.
Oh, I see.
Plus, everything is spherical, which you clearly see it's not. But, this is not to say that it's excluded, it's just the theory is not yet to the.
But then, where are fundamental reasons why this was wrong? Then you could tell them. Waste time trying to calculate the bullet cluster.
Yeah.
It would be
useful. Didn't they have to put in particularly massive neutrinos?
Yeah.
Or certainly rolled out.
Right.
Mm.
Well, 2 ED, I think, would they
have?
Yeah. Is that rolled out? I mean,
as far as I know, it's pretty hard up against it.
I believe they mentioned Catherine and it was 2.2. So they pushed it all the way to the limit where they can still get away with it. But because they couldn't push it higher, their gas mass came out wrong. So that was the problem. If they could accommodate 4 EV neutrinos, their gas mass would be okay.
Starlink knows.
In the early 70s, right, when this business about testing GR was getting organized, if you wanted to be a graduate student of Kip Thorne, right, you had to pass a little test. And the test was to construct one alternative theory of gravity, right, that was consistent with all the data up to that point. And you were allowed anything, 10 vector fields, scalar fields, work in the weak field limit. So there were a lot of theories of gravity that were proposed and then suddenly basically axed by this program. It seems to me, if you're interested in this general subject, as in lensing, it would be a good idea not to sort of focus on one particular theory like this. Because after all, the whole history of Mon, as I read it just from Jacob's primer, is there was Mon, and then that had some problem, and they produced something, and then they produced something. So if you keep trying to, the theorists don't have to have real data, they will, maybe we have two vector fields, right, that will fit the data with more parameters. I think it might be a very interesting exercise to sort of have some phenomenological framework like the PPN, formalism that you could fit the various data that you have to and determine the parameters and then look for a theory, right, that maybe produces those parameters if they differ from the ones in general relativity. That's difficult to do in cosmology, right, because it would be easy, I think, if we only had recent data, but in fact we've got sort of data from two ends, but it may not be beyond the realm of possibility to do that. Thanks very much.